You know, I've reached a point where I can't read too long at any one time. It takes a while after I stop reading to get my eyes refocused.
Really?
Yeah. You know, they don't change the focus as rapidly as
it is.
They've been in and out of the house before.
Yeah. And someone who knew what they were doing.
Or somebody who certainly knew antique. And you don't find very many garden variety housebreakers. No antiques.
Oh, you found the cheese.
Yeah. But I don't really got anything to do with that.
Well, we'll make it.
If anybody wants a banana, David doesn't. I don't think. Jack, would you like one?
No, thank you. Peanut butter is what I call emergency ration.
Yeah.
Oh?
Anytime Bertie doesn't show up or goes away, leaves me to fix my own lunches, I always head for the peanut butter.
Well, it's a treat, isn't it?
Sure.
I don't know. Some people I don't think ever get tired of it.
I can eat peanut butter, a little of it, every day.
I have known people who ate peanut butter for breakfast.
Uh-huh. I lived with a girl for 2 years who ate peanut butter for breakfast every morning. Toast and peanut butter.
I eat a large amount of it every day, except don't.
Well, that's certainly a natural food, outside of a little preservatives and something they put in to keep it from hardening.
It don't preserve me, does it?
You look pretty well preserved.
Guy? I'd like to get into it a little bit more myself. Never hadn't heard it at all. All those three cities are kind of in each other's backyard or front yard. Greensboro.
Winston, Salem, Greensboro, and High Point.
And then they don't have much in common. They're so different.
They're different.
Mm-hmm. That's a job.
Greensboro is a city of industries, mostly corporations, light industry, textiles, cigarettes, Western Electric has a big place there, pharmaceuticals, Siva Gaggi has a big plant there, and apparently it's they send their executives into Greensboro to work for a while on their way up the ladder, and after they stay there 2 or 3 years, well, they leave and go somewhere else, and other executives come in.
So it's mobile. It's
transient. Sort of a transient place. Yes, there's not a strong native population there. There probably was at one time, but you seldom run into them now. Sort of like Florida here. It's hard to find a native-born Floridian. And so there's considerable money there, but the money is always going in and out. It doesn't accumulate in big family fortunes in Greensboro. So it's pretty hard to get anything done for the city as a civic place, because people simply don't think of it as their hometown. Mm-hmm. You see, or their home city. They're always on their way somewhere else. So when you come to talking about establishing, say, symphony orchestras or schools and civic improvements of one sort or another, it's a little harder to get these things done than some of the other cities. Winston.
Winston has it.
Winston has the old family, the Reynoldses and the Richardsons and others that have lived there for a long, long time, and have grown up in that tobacco operation, and big tobacco money, like the Dukes.
Is the Dukes a family?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. But they're not in Winston. They were in Durham. They're tobacco money, too. But Winston has these old families, and it's still sort of a factory town situation with the big cigarette factories there, and lots of workers, and relatively small middle class, and then these big wealthy families, the plant owners and managers, the executives. But they are really, if you want to look at the cultural life of a city, in the sense of schools, orchestras, and art museums, and that sort of thing. They have more than that at Winston than Greensboro has, because they have this big money.
Mm-hmm.
And the money is in relatively few hands. So you don't have to go around and go from door to door and knock on the doors to collect money to do anything. You just pick up the telephone and call two or three people. And if they agreeable, well, it's all there, and the package is put together. You can do it, so they say, in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, they can raise $4 or $5 million with no trouble at all. So they have these things, and there's a little more tradition, old fashioned ways of doing things in Winston and Greensboro. High Point, on the other hand, is sort of the backyard of the other two. It's a manufacturing city. Furniture, big furniture, you know. Well, you've been to
it. Oh, yeah.
I don't need to tell Debbie all these things.
I don't know all
she's
those
been
things.
I never went to Greensboro or Winston-Salem or High Point in my whole 4 years up there.
Well, High Point.
I've forgotten. You said the other night it was a furniture place.
Oh,
I've already forgotten that. I keep thinking it's all textiles up there.
No. It has some textiles, of course, but mostly in connection with furniture, you know, weaving, what do you call them? Covers for chairs and all that.
Yeah, oh, really?
Right. Mm-hmm. So there are some textiles there, some chemicals, particularly plastic, because they use a lot of plastic in furniture nowadays. They can't get the wood. They use plastic. Well, they're big plastic plants and finishing plants. But, they have two big markets there twice a year. People come from all over the world to the High Point furniture market. Buyers, you know, to pick out lines of furniture.
Yeah. And place orders.
And place orders. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many different big firms. And Drexel has a big firm there. I don't know the name of the furniture. I haven't bought any furniture in so long.
Anybody in the furniture business would sort of have to keep in touch with them.
Oh, yes.
Like
yes.
Cox. You see, Cox is all over Florida now. It has
yes.
Branches out
mm-hmm.
there,
mm-hmm.
I'd say. So they'd have to do that, wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess they have two big centers for furniture manufacturing in the country. One of them is, of course, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and the other one's in High Point.
Yeah.
And when they have these big markets, you can't get a motel room for miles around. They fill up the motels in Winston and Greensboro and High Point. And,
Oh,
big doing.
All that's got to come out of the price of furniture.
That's right. That's right. You're paying for those motel rooms. Mm-hmm. buy your furniture. But the markup on furniture is tremendously high anyway. Next to jewelry, it's about the highest markup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like that is not perishable, you see, so it looks like it ought to be the least.
Yeah, you'd think so. But I guess with the population increasing the way it has been up until recently, there was always somebody buying new furniture.
It's a little like jewelry. You can't tell by looking at it how good it is.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes. Of course, this big old furniture that they used to have in the cheap furniture stores with all the curly veneer with what they call waterfall, you know,
mm-hmm.
and big, tremendous things with what they call borax. The furniture people call it borax. I don't know why, how they got that name for it, but it's very cheap furniture, cheap veneer on, but it looks impressive. You know, sort of like impressive, sort of a childish taste for size and display.
You wouldn't have my problem, you see. I can't get undershirts or shorts and things like that that I want, or trousers.
Mm-hmm.
But over there,
you'll probably find them all.
Bertie goes to.
Goes to the company stores, that is the employee stores. Bluebell, which is a firm that makes blue jeans and overalls, work clothes. They have an employee store, supposedly where the employees of the company can pick up things at discount prices, perhaps seconds, things with slight flaws. They sell cheap. And she goes to this employee store and buys a lot of things for us. Sears has a big warehouse there with an employee store. You can go in and buy things that are slightly damaged in shipment. Or sometimes things have been repossessed or they're cheaper. And there's lots and lots of what they call outlet stores. Outlet stores, using little holes in the wall, who buy up seconds from the mills all around and sell them at a pretty good discount. And if you are careful, if you shop around in these outlet places, frequently you can get very good, very good things for very little money. You just have to be careful. You have to know what it is that's wrong with this particular thing as to why it's in that outlet store rather than being sold on a regular retail basis. These mills, they have separate, sales forces. They have a sales force that sells their regular first line stuff, and they have another sales force that goes out and sells all the seconds and remnants. And there are lots of remnant stores up there. You see, when you run cloth through these big looms, the first maybe 100 feet of this run of cloth
mm-hmm.
Has various little errors in it until they get the loom adjusted just right. So after they've had a run of this particular pattern through the loom, there are also some of these errors at the end of the run. They might get slightly out of whack, and so they've cut off those ends. And they only use the center, which of course is pretty big, much bigger than the end. But they take those ends and sell them to the remnant places. And you can cut those things up, and sometimes they sell them for pillow, to make pillow cases out of, or they sell them to make tablecloths, or use them for almost anything. Bertie gets some of them, this heavy drapery material. Or some of these things that they make for covering chairs, chair seats with. And she makes handbags, you know, these sort of big shopping bags out of them for the church bazaar.
Oh. No wonder she's working for the bazaar. She's got plenty to work with.
Oh, yeah. It just takes a little imagination.
That's
what you want to use
in a different light. Every time Jack writes, he says Bertie's working on something for the bazaar, for the church, or something like that.
Well, sometimes she's weaving things for him, but she got hooked into this deal. I think her church chapter agreed to make up these handbags, and they went out to one of these outlet places and picked up samples. Now, a lot of times on these, particularly these heavy drapery materials, they'll send out or have in the store samples there. Ooh, about maybe this long and roughly square, that square. And they'll be on a rack. So that all the different patterns, all the different designs are sort of like a book, you know, you peel them.
Oh, yeah.
And you go through and pick out the patterns that you want. Well, every once in a while when they bring out a new line and they run out of the material for these patterns, they'll sell these big bundles of sample folders. And you can pull those, separate them, pull them out and do all kinds of things.
I want to get this straight, Jack, about the Lights Liberty ships, because I'm gonna work on this book, Jeff, ain't I? Anyway, you want to, don't mind. Now, the Lights Liberty ships, that's World War I Liberty ships, and they were adapted, no, they were built with cabins in them.
Extra cabins for cadets. That is, people who were training for the Merchant Marine during the war, First World War.
Oh.
They were, you know, like in the Second World War, they had to train a lot of extra men to man all these new ships they were building, hand over fist, these Liberty boats.
Mm. Yeah.
So they had they carried cadets. Each Liberty boat that was launched, as part of its crew, had some cadets that would be in training, that after they'd been on a couple of voyages would be signed on as regular crew members for the next Liberty boat that were being launched. This was the system. Well, anyway, I think they had cabins for this particular Liberty boat, had quarters for six cadets, was pretty good proportion because the crew was only about 14 or 16 men, that is the seamen, in addition to the officers. But the cadets were training to be officers, so they were up. Their quarters were up near the officers' quarters in the ship, in other words, they weren't part of the forecastle, the able seamen's quarters. They were part of the officers' country. So after the war was over, I guess Likes.
But they all ate together.
They did on this ship. Mm-hmm. They did on this ship. But after the war, the Lights brothers, you know, who have all the big cattle ranches and
packing houses
and
the
whatnot,
yeah,
down around Tampa, they apparently bought up several of these Liberty boats because they have a Lights brothers steamship line too, and that's, this ship was a part of this
That was in 37 when you knew it.
When I knew it, yeah. And they sailed out of, mostly out of the Gulf, Gulf ports, Houston and New Orleans. And
that's where you caught it.
Caught it in New Orleans. Now you'd think that we should have been able to have caught it at Tampa. That's where it ought to have been, because my roommate lived in Tampa and I lived in Jacksonville at that time. And we had to travel over to New Orleans to catch this boat.
Oh.
Yeah. Went over on the Southern train.
Yeah. And it's all that Gulf and all, and it didn't stop after it left at New Orleans.
No, it would leave New Orleans, go down around Florida, between Florida and Cuba, catch the Gulf Stream, going north and follow the Gulf Stream and the Great Circle route all the way to London. Then after it unloaded or loaded, I don't know, I think it was unloaded in London, it would sail on back down the channel into the Mediterranean and unload and pick up stuff in the Mediterranean, and then out the Mediterranean, anywhere else they might send them. That was the nice thing about these freighters. You never knew that if you stayed on. You never knew where you'd be going next or when you'd get there, because we tried to book round-trip passage on this light ship. We couldn't do it. They could book us passage over because they knew when it was going to leave New Orleans and when it'd get to London, but after it got to London, they didn't know when it would be anywhere. So they couldn't promise us a return passage at any particular time or from any particular place.
Yeah. But it just cost you $50.
$50 one way.
Oh my.
Right, from here to London.
Good heavens.
3 weeks.
New Orleans. It took about 3 weeks.
Well, that's a pretty good time.
Yeah, it wouldn't make more than 12 knots. It just wallowed along, you know. It was loaded down when we left New Orleans. It was loaded down so low that if just a little squall came up, waves would wash over the lower deck.
Oh, they loaded it down.
Yeah, it was really loaded down. I forgot what the cargo was. I think there was some lumber, there was cement.
Well, the merchant marine, did they run it?
Yeah, this was merchant marine.
Well, now the merchant marine, you might say, has two parts. One that runs the ship, and like the engineer and the oiler and the all, and one that keeps the ship.
The deck.
Housekeeping.
The deck.
The boatswain.
Yeah, right. Well, now by merchant marine is a sort of a semi-governmental arrangement. There are schools that are run by the government to train merchant marine people.
That.
They are. Of course, they don't get all the people from these schools, but the government does run some schools to train merchant marine, or at least they did at that time.
Yeah.
But once they're trained, it's like, you know, training doctors or anything else. The graduates of these schools can go anywhere they can get a job, wherever they want to go. So in one sense, you refer to the American merchant marine, what you're referring to is every ship that flies the American flag. That's a merchant marine. So these are, of course, supposedly mostly commercial lines, like Likes or American Export or
the banana routes from Central America.
No, they sometimes have American officers on them. But I understand most of those have Panamania registry.
Yes.
Most of the merchant marine that normally would be American has Panamanian registry. They don't fly the American flag. Because if they did, they'd have to abide by the American regulations about safety and the treatment of the crews and all that sort of thing.
And wages.
Wages, wage levels and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So they register them out of Panama with fly the Panamanian flag. And then they're not subject to American.
Now you saw some of the like Mr. Eastman and the milk strike, you saw some of that going on in the American Marine.
Oh yes. That was back in the organize. I think it was the CIO that was just being organizing at that time, just challenging the American Federation of Labor, which was the big union at that time. And these people on the likes, the crew on the likes, had an organizer amongst them who was apparently organizing, trying to organize the crew to sign up with CIO. And he drew up a list of demands that he wanted to make on the captain for treatment of the crew and hours of work and wages and all this sort of thing.
And I remember now, Jack was up there where they was coming and going, and he had a typewriter, you see.
Yeah, I was. They saw that typewriter, and so after they had their meetings in the foxhole, one of them came up and had this list of demands and asked me to type it and make a copy. So I did, and apparently they took it up to the captain and they had some sort of a row. And they were talking about mutiny, the crew was going to mutiny, not in the sense that they would take over the ship, like the Bounty or that sort of thing, but they just sort of sit down and not work until their demands were met. And things looked a little tight for a while. And I wondered just how I fit into the picture for having typed that list of demands for. And the captain was talking to me about it. I guess he wanted just to find out what had been going on. And he asked me about it. And I told him, yeah, I typed it. And he says, well, we don't have to worry. He says, things get a little tight. There's an American cruiser about 50 miles off, and all I have to do is to radio an American cruiser, and things are straightened out. No more trouble. No more.
Yeah. And now, as to what any individuals did and bucking for a little better treatment, a better food, or anything, you wouldn't necessarily see. Well, no, you wouldn't necessarily see that.
No, I wouldn't see it. Of course, food. They ate the same food that we did, and it was pretty good.
Oh, I see.
Well, they didn't have any complaint about the food, or at least they didn't have any legitimate complaint about it.
In the 30s, food wasn't a great item anyhow, was
no,
it?
There was plenty of it, and, well, I was just noticing when I was reading this Golden Sun novel, Kirkpatrick's here, he talks about the crew, any time they came off watch or something, they opened the refrigerator, and there were cold cuts and sandwiches and that sort of thing piled up in there, and as long as they can eat, that food is shoveled out to them.
Yeah, but now that comes from the union, but he never lets on that there are any agitators or any union activities.
Well, maybe they weren't in his time. After all, the union's pretty well control merchant marine now.
What time do you think his is?
I think his is after the Second World War. Now, let's see, when I don't know, that's 37.
Yeah.
That's before.
Oh, you mean the union had already got everything and he wouldn't see it?
Yeah. He wouldn't see any union activities. They already organized. Before they even sign on the ship.
Yeah.
In fact, they have to be members of the union in order to get a berth on the ship.
Well, you had the union still active because you had, after World War One, World War Two, you had the integration problem, and not so much the colored people, I think that too, but the Puerto Ricans and
mm-hmm.
people like that.
I guess so.
Well, anyhow, I don't, I wasn't there, so. Well, now, how much did you see of those birds?
Not very much, really. We saw more of the officers. Of course, there were only about four officers. We saw more of them than we saw of the crew. Of course, we'd see them working around, and we'd talk to them and chat with them every once in a while.
Crew.
Yeah. But really didn't see too much of them.
The bosun.
We had a captain and we had a first mate, a second mate, an engineer. But I didn't see much of the engineer at all, except at meals. And a bosun.
Bosun was
Well, as I say, he's sort of like a warrant officer in the Army. He's neither quite one or quite the other, but he stays with the crew. He bunks with the crew. He's a of the non-commissioned, highest non-commissioned. He's the one that gets things done on the ship as far as the crew is concerned.
He's a sergeant.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Top sergeant.
Right, the sergeant.
Top sergeant. I'm going to tell you, Jack, you've read Debbie's stuff on the her French experience. I'm going to tell you what to do. Now, what did you tell about your army experience in this country? You didn't say much about it. The only thing you said about it in this country, you was at that ordnance center up in Maryland.
Aberdeen.
Mm-hmm. That I thought was in Texas. And what you saw there, you didn't particularly care to go to the officer training school.
No. I wasn't impressed by the quality of the officers that I saw.
Yeah. Now that's amazing. That's like Mr. Leland.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
As I was telling Guy,
I didn't have that much sense.
Most of the ones that we saw at Aberdeen Proving Grounds, that is the headquarters of the Ordnance Department, were used car salesmen that had gotten their commissions through connections with General Motors or Chrysler or Ford or
uh-huh.
you know, who had big ordnance contracts. And,
yes, Lord help us, yes, they would have plenty of pull.
Sure. And they'd see to it that their dealers and whatnot got just about anything that they wanted. So they'd
uh-huh.
come in with direct commissions, some of them without even going through OCS,
yeah.
the Officers Training School. And, A lot of them, OTS, a lot of them were good old country boys from small towns. One I had at the anti-aircraft school was from Alabama. Big old red-headed, ruddy-faced, hefty, sort of paunchy character that was good-natured enough, but he didn't have brains enough to blow his hat off in the wind today with dynamite.
Now, he's not the one that checked in of a morning.
Yeah, that's the one. He had quarters off the coast somewhere. I think he had his wife there. And he would wander in around 9:30 or 10 in the morning, look around and ask if there was anything that he was supposed to sign. I was, in addition to being an instructor there, I was clerk, shop clerk, too. They found out I could type. That's what happens to anyone. The minute they find out you can type, they stick you in one of these clerk things.
At least they didn't make you a chauffeur.
No. I was only a chauffeur once, and that was one cold, blizzardy night, also at Aberdeen, when I was pulling guard duty. And at that time, I was fortunate I wasn't stuck in one of the posts where you just walk around, you know, and all that sweeping cold wind that comes off the bay, Chesapeake Bay, up over those flatlands. But they put me in the Jeep. There was one Jeep that made the rounds, you see, of this area that was we were responsible for. Driving around, in addition to the ones who were walking that post. Well, it happened this time, they stuck me in that drive Jeep. And of course, the officer of the day, in charge of the guard, drives around with me. I drove him around, and that's what it amounted to, so he could check on all the different posts. Well, sir, at this particular time when we were making our rounds, it had been snowing. A blizzard it really was. And it snowed and it snowed and it snowed. And you know how it is, you get big banks of snow on a road or around it. You can lose your bearings because all the familiar landmarks are covered up. And I drove this officer, and I'm sure that it was just by blind luck. I didn't run that Jeep off into the ditch or into some of these big iron posts that they stick up at corners with chains, you know, between them. In fact, I almost ran into one, and it scared the living daylights out of this officer. And he says, "You know, I didn't see that thing. Did you see it?" I said, "Oh, sure." I thought, nothing to be worried about. I hadn't seen it either. I wasn't going to let him know. And we were skidding around all over the place that night. That's the only chauffeuring job that I had. And it was enough for him. He didn't go out anymore that night. And that pleased me because I didn't have to go out either.
You didn't see much of the enlisted men at that base, because you didn't get around or didn't do anything. Go back to the barracks and read a book or something.
Well, it depends on how you mean see them. You work with them all day long. This was a school, and of course the instructors were enlisted men. For the most part.
Oh, you were an instructor.
I was an instructor. Yeah. And the people they would send in there to go to this school were enlisted. Occasionally you'd get a platoon of officers who would be sent there for some sort of specialized training in demolition or instrument repair or some sort. But, this was all practically all in this enlisted man's world.
Well, now you didn't talk about any of the enlisted men there. You until you got over at Le Mans.
Well,
and that's where you saw the enlisted men, and you didn't care to be in that officer training stuff.
Well, that was at Aberdeen.
Yeah.
Well, the enlisted men were more interesting, mainly because I saw more of them. And what I saw the officers, I didn't like. And what the difference is, I'm not so sure, except that the old concept of the officer and the gentleman,
yeah,
you see, was completely dead as a dodo, probably by the Civil War. And it certainly wasn't alive when I was there.
Yeah.
And perhaps I found more gentlemen among the enlisted men, because they didn't have pull with General Motors. So they weren't used crossing.
I haven't had any experience like that. I don't quite see how that gentleman idea works out with the enlisted men.
Well, you know, when you go into basic training, they give you a battery of tests that are supposed to find out your aptitude, and then they are supposed to assign you different branches of the service.
They're supposed to discard all them tests and put you where they want you.
Well, that's what they do. Well, what they happen to need at a particular time. If they're overrun with, Air Force personnel, if you enlist to be in the Air Force, well, you know, all of a sudden you'll find yourself in the infantry,
yeah,
instead of the Air Force.
Or the Ordnance.
Or the Ordnance, or some other place, so you never know. But at any rate, according to your showing on this test, you're supposed to be sent to such and such a branch. Now, if you're completely a numbskull, they send you to Cooks and Bakers School, where you learn to cook. Or supposedly learned to cook. All the cooks I saw, some of them were pretty smart, but they were all drunkards. I don't know what the connection is, but that was true.
Yeah.
But apparently, a lot of the college people made pretty good scores on this, some aspect of these batteries. And if they showed pretty well on the mechanical side, they'd send them to the ordnance department. And apparently, a great many pretty smart boys got into the ordnance department because of this particular aptitude. And I wouldn't be surprised at what some of them got in there through pool. I mean, they had highly placed parents, or their parents had friends that didn't want them in the infantry, so they shipped them into the ordnance department. So, by and large, you had a fairly good quality of mind in most of the enlisted men. Now, you did have some other, shall I say, more interesting ones. We had in our barracks a number of Italian and Poles, that is, Italian extraction, Polish extraction. And you talk about anarchy. Those Italians and those Poles, the Italians were from Jersey, New Jersey, most of them. And the Poles, I don't know, somewhere around Hamtramck or someplace. They were filling station or mechanics, garage mechanics in civilian life. But you talk about your ethnic qualities that show up strongest in these two nationalities, at least as I saw. And any of the other people in there, of course, they were Germans, and there were Swedes, and there were Scotch and Irish, and Lord knows what all in there. But the Italians and the Poles were most distinctive, or it seemed to have maintained.
You
heard from them. They were loud, for one thing. Those Poles used to, as soon as a bugle would blow to get us up in the morning, they had radios, you know, up above their bunks. And there was one station somewhere in Baltimore there that started off in the morning playing nothing but polkas. And these Poles would turn on those polkas, and they'd get out there and they'd stomp and they'd dance and go on around in that barrack. If anybody wanted to sleep or tried to sleep, it was impossible with all those Polacks stomping and dancing before we'd get out to work.
But they had a light on their feet.
Light on their feet, yeah.
And they
thick heads, but light feet.
Yeah.
And some of them weren't so thick headed either, but.
And they'd actually get out there.
And oh yeah, they'd dance and stomp and go around and polka and dance a polka together.
Yeah. Well, that's not get part anybody of dancing like this.
No. Yeah, and the Italians, I think some of the Italians must have been mafia boys. They were mean. Couldn't trust them.
You wouldn't take your stuff.
They would if you didn't keep an eye on it. You know, lock it up.
Well, in the army, everything's plentiful, and there's not much inducement to steal.
Well, except that they take it out in pocket. There's always inducement to get money, and they knew all the ways.
Oh.
They had contacts outside the base, and I'm pretty sure some of them are mafia boys. Just illusions they would make sometimes. Talk about ways.
Jack, over in Le Mans now, what was the big difference? You carry on about the same?
No, there's a big difference in Le Mans because, in the first place, once you get overseas, a lot of these regulations and spit and polish sort of things are dropped.
Yeah.
And that was true over in Le Mans. You put in a day's work, but once you were back, I think the colonel in charge of the battalion tried to have every once in a while some sort of a parade or review of the whole unit. There were only two in the year that I was there. One of them was because there was a visiting general that stopped by. But I think he became so discouraged that he never did have nerve enough to have another one after the general left. Maybe the general said a few things to him about the way we looked, but he didn't have any more. But it was pretty much like civilian arrangement once you got overseas. When you got through, you couldn't go around in civilian clothes because nobody had any civilian clothes. But you were loose. And you'd go into town, and do whatever you wanted to at night, and get out so long as you were back to turn out the next morning.
Of course, you were lucky when you went out. You run into lady who was a musician.
Yeah, that's Claudette Chicot. She was Well, the Red Cross tried to have entertainments and dances and some sort of special events for all the servicemen in that particular area in Le Mans, once a week or so, just for morale. And they would, the Red Cross would throw these dances, and they would get girls from the city to come to these dances to provide partners for the enlisted men. And these girls were supposedly from good families, and I think most of them were good families. And the cooks in the various unit mess halls around the place would get together the night of before the night of the dance and make cakes and cookies and send in so there'd be plenty of refreshments for these dances. And the particular night I went was shortly after I joined this battalion at Le Mans. I went in just to see was going on, see some of the town, and wound up at this dance. And I danced with one girl, and she spoke very good English, which was fortunate because my French was strictly GI, a little of that. But she spoke very good English, and it turns out that she was she worked in Paris during the week, or most of the time, and sort of commuted occasional weekends back from Paris to Le Mans. She sang. I don't know what she was doing then, because I don't know whether the opera was performing, but she normally sang in the chorus in the opera in Paris. And she spoke very good English. She was interested in music. She was a violinist, a very good violinist. And we got along fine, talking about one thing or another. So she gave me her home address. Says anytime I wanted to practice, because I didn't have any fiddle along with me, that I was welcome to come to her home and borrow her violin, which was there, and practice as long as I wanted to. Well, that was agreeable. And then towards the end of the dance, when everybody stopped for refreshments, it's amazing. The minute they pull the covers off the table with all the cakes and things on it, every one of those girls just took off and headed for that table, and they were almost fighting over that cake, those cakes and cookies. And they were stuffing them in their handbags. They all had brought these big bags, you know, handbags. And they were stuffing these things in their handbags to take home with them. They didn't need them there, but they were going to take them home. And that was one of the first times that I realized that these people were hungry. That the real reason that these girls were coming to this dance was not to dance with those handsome soldiers. They were sick of soldiers by that time. But they got this food, and they could load up and carry home as much as they could. And that might last them for, or help their families for a good two or three meals. So I thought, well, gee, if this is the way things are, these people aren't interested in us. You know, so American soldiers, anyhow. Because the French, at that time, which was shortly after the end of the war, European war, so they looked upon us as another army of occupation. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you noticed or heard something about that while you were in France. They got rid of the German army of occupation, but then they had the American army of occupation. so I thought I'd not see any more of them. But bless Pat, 2 or 3 days later, I was fiddling around in the quarters at the Cité de Pain outside of Le Mans, the big housing development, which we had taken over, incidentally. The battalion had taken over and kicked all the French people out of their homes. And I looked up, and there Claudette was. She had bicycled out from Le Mans, and I was on the inside of the compound, and she was on the outside. I couldn't ask her in. They weren't supposed to be in. The French civilians weren't supposed to be in. So we just did that defense and talked back and forth a lot. And she told me something about the attitude that the French had towards us as a
occupying
army. But last Pat, and a little while later, she asked me out to dinner at her home. And by then, I appreciated what that invitation meant, because they were all short of food. And I didn't see how they were going to feed me anything, since they were short anyway. So when I agreed to come, well, I went around to the kitchen. I knew the cook, and I loaded up with coffee and sugar and some canned goods and all that sort of thing. And so when I went, I took these with me. And bless that, they had a fine dinner. Of course, one what I took, they had already scoured around and found it even complete with meat. I don't know what they had to do to get that or where they got it. They may have had to take a day's trip out into the countryside, bicycle or something, to get this and bring it back in. I don't know. But they put on a fine meal, and her mother and father were living in this apartment on the Rue Lamartine. And ding-a-ling.
Hello? Okay. John Eve is out here, but I think he's not going to stay.
Yeah, we'll send that.
They're going to leave.
Yeah.
A jeep tour. The army would give us jeeps and let us take off from this place in a couple of weeks. We stopped over in one of those big old farmhouses.
That's what I want to hear about.
It was a sort of an inn, or and you could stay overnight.
Now this was on your jeep tour.
Yeah, on the way down the, through Normandy, and. We got meals, of course, and they asked us what we wanted to eat, and we could pick out most anything there, because they had all this produce and all this eggs and chickens and whatnot, and no place, nothing to do with them, because of transport between Normandy and Paris, or the big metropolitan centers, was still pretty weak and shaky.
Oh, that was in Normandy,
yeah.
I somehow put that down south of France.
Oh, well, now, what I was talking about was further down on the Spanish border, but this was on the way down there.
Oh.
We stopped in one night, and we were going to have a salad and an omelet and steak, and we got the works, all right. But while we come down, we were standing around the kitchen waiting for them to eat in the kitchen, a big table, waiting for them to put the food on the table for us. And the one of the farm girls was fixing the salad, and she had a sort of wire chicken fence basket, and she put lettuce. She's out in the backyard in the farmhouse. She put lettuce in this maybe some endives or something, and then she'd stick it under the pump and pump water on it. And then she'd swing it around and around and around to swing all the water out of it before she put it down. Well, she'd put the water on it, and she started swinging, and all of a sudden it slipped out of her hand, sailed over and, you know, the farm muck and so forth, and rolled over a couple of times. She went over and picked it up and sort of shook it a little bit like that and walked right in with it. That's what we had. That's the sound we had.
The hell with that old sanitation.
Well, that's right.
Don't worry about that.
More water.
No. Yeah.
And but the real tour was down south.
Yeah, long. Well, the whole thing was a tour, but we spent more time there because we wanted to look at the mountains, and we weren't far from Lourdes, and we picked out a little border town called Pope, little city, nice little city, very pretty little city.
Small, you went as far south as you could go.
Pope wasn't as far south as we could go, but that was our headquarters. We put up at a little hotel in Poe. I was telling the guy which
spot. P-O-Po?
P-A-U. P-A-U. And we swapped our sea rations and so forth for our board.
Mm.
Room and board in this hotel. But we would leave all our junk there in our rooms, and we'd take the Jeep, and we'd, you know, go out on excursions in all different directions. One of them was to the border. We hoped to get across the Spanish border just to say that we had been in Spain. And, it was one of those, the border post there was nothing at all. It was just sort of little crossroads, except that it was in a very narrow pass between two mountains going into Spain.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a very strong fortification built into the wall of the mountain on one side, and the road ran on the mountain alongside the other mountain, with just a little gully of water running down between the road and the fort, border fort. And that's all that was there. Was a border fort and I guess maybe a few stores or little shops that lived off of the garrison. And it was garrisoned by goons. You ever seen any goons in France?
What?
Goons.
Never heard of them.
G-O-U-M-S. Goons. They're Algerian Arabic soldiers, Moroccans, some of them. But they call them all goons. And at that time, of course, they were colonial troops with a French officer in charge. And they manned this fort garrison, this fort. And they were big, burly fellows with long beards, spade beards, came down to here.
Dandies.
Turbans. And they were supposed to be pretty mean customers. Of course, we didn't see much of them. But we started to go across the border, and they wouldn't let us go across. And they took us to this French officer. And he didn't speak any English. And we had to get by on our pidgin French. But the gist of what he had to say was that he sympathized with our interest in Spain, and he would we wish very much that he could assist us in going across the border, but he couldn't assume the responsibility that the people of the Mountaineers across the border had a fondness for three things. One of them was shoes, good shoes. The other was firearms. The other was jeeps, and we had all three. we were always supposed to carry our carbines along with us. We had these M1 carbines, and we had good shoes on, and we had the jeep. And he said, if I let you go across the border, you wouldn't get 5 miles down the road. We'd have to send somebody out and pick you, what's left of you, up and bring you back. So he wouldn't, he says he couldn't assume responsibility for us, so he wouldn't let us go across. But that's an interesting area because it's a border area.
Mm-hmm.
And you find French-speaking people there and Spanish-speaking people there and Basque-speaking people there and sometimes people who speak in a mixture of all of them at one time.
Yeah.
And then there were these gooms here who were speaking Arabic. And a funny thing happened to me when I would, I studied Spanish mostly when I was going through school. And I discovered something funny. When I run across one of these Spanish-speaking people, I thought, well, gee, I can get along fine here. And I'd start to speak Spanish to them, and darn, if what would come out would be my version of French. And when I'd run into a Frenchman, I'd start to speak French, and darn, if what wouldn't come out was Spanish. I don't know what causes a little quirk like that.
I was thinking that.
Yeah,
but that's what would happen. And they were all smugglers, all the people along it. A collection of smugglers and expatriates from Spain had been run out by Franco in the Civil War. They were living all along the border there, hoping, you know, sometime or other to get back in Spain, and while they were waiting, stirring up all the trouble they could for the Franco government. We ran into, in this little town of Pau, we ran into, I think he was the Belgian consul. All these little cities have consulates, you know, usually it's some local businessman who sort of acts as an agent for different governments. Sometimes he'd be a consul of three or four different governments.
Hmm.
But this was a Belgian consul. And we started chatting with him. I don't know how we ran into him, but we started chatting with him. And he took us out to his home. A very nice home, typically French for that part of of France. A sort of airy and light and white. Big rooms with tile floors. And
I like to see that.
But he wanted to work out a deal. I forgot what it was, what the deal was. Anyhow, what he wanted was cigarettes. He wanted cigarettes. He couldn't get American cigarettes that part of the world for love nor money. In fact, all the time I was in France, you didn't really have to spend much money. In fact, you had this occupation, French, American money. Everybody used cigarettes for currency, for money. If you wanted something, you just paid a certain number of cigarettes, a certain number of packages of cigarettes, or even some big cartons of cigarettes. It was general currency. So he wanted cigarettes. Well, we had some, so we gave him some cigarettes. I've forgotten what what he was supposed to have done, or if he didn't. And it wasn't anything very important. But it was a nice glimpse into his home and the way he worked. Being a consul at that time, when trade and business and commerce was pretty well disorganized, he didn't have much to do. So he lived rather graceful and leisurely life.
Well, Dang, let me tell you, I'm going to ask him. You know, I said the other night, that there's one suggestion. I didn't mean to meddle, but I just talking by way of discourse, as Hopper says, you know. If I could make a suggestion, you see, to your children, Barbara and Donald, see, from what you said about it, see, they are overextended. See, they reach out in so many directions that I'd prescribe a good book every now and then, and also to use it, you see, to use that attack I talk about and get a hold of it where it would be some use to you.
You could prescribe that guy. I couldn't do it because I'm their father.
I'm talking about all this reading you said they did.
Yeah. Yeah. But you see, they're there and I'm somewhere else.
Yeah, I understand that. But see, it wouldn't do any good for me too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't get anywhere with it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was thinking of is what you way it opened up their reading, like with Barbara and with Donald. Now that's what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Debbie don't know about that. Just line it out a little bit for her. That's what I was thinking about. See, Donald works all day, and then he comes back to the house and figures and calculates and reads and all sorts of things. So. Midnight, I guess.
Yeah, and we sometimes get into the talks about one thing or another that he's reading. But those occasions have to sort of just happen.
Yeah.
It's hard to plan on. Because the minute you start planning things, then Don gets a feeling that we are running his life for him. And, no young man or woman likes that idea.
He'd get my number right quick. You see, I wouldn't get anywhere as far as that goes.
You can sort of sometimes enticing him to these things.
Well, how about that? How about just a quick look at that? Now, let me see. What brought that up when you were talking about the Shakespeare thing? What I asked you, what we were talking about was the publishers or editors, you see, who would look at your manuscript and give you a little hand. And Jack said it wasn't the editors who did his. How did you put that? That helped you?
Well, of course they do help you some, but you have to argue your own case. You have to peddle your own wares.
I'm talking about these readers who made suggestions.
Oh, yeah.
And it worked out in your case to where it was a pretty simple thing that you finally got a hold of.
Yeah, well, that wasn't through the readers, so that was my own doing. In other words, see, I'm in a little college, Debbie, and only about 500-600 students. And I'm the only person who is supposed to know anything about Renaissance literature on faculty. Of course, now there's some people on the faculty that know quite a bit about Renaissance literature, but that's my sort of special bailiwick. And the others won't talk to me about Renaissance literature, or at least they think that they're stepping on my toes if they do that. So I don't have anybody to talk to, and I didn't have when I was writing this book. You see, I'd had the Guggenheim and used it for a year, but that was back in 58. And I hadn't had a grant or anything since 1958 when I was working on this third volume. That was in 62, 63, and I had to do it pretty much on my own with what I had gotten from this Guggenheim stamp and microfilms and writing or talking to a few people that I could talk with over at Duke and Chapel Hill. You can't do very much that way. They have their own work to do. So I had to do this pretty much on my own. And this little thing that I ran across was simply something that probably anybody would run across if they were looking for the same sort of things that I was looking for, and went through all the tragedies, which I did. And of course, I'd already gone through the comedies.
Well, what you found in the comedies, it was the art song.
Yes. There are occasional ballads or snatches of ballads in the comedies too, every once in a while. But by and large, almost entirely, it's the art songs that Shakespeare puts in the comedies. Songs that can stand by themselves as pieces of composition, mm-hmm. musical composition. You see, you listen to the music in them. Of course, you might listen to the words too. And of course, Shakespeare uses them for dramatic purposes. But the music is there. It is a musical composition that you're listening to. But in the tragedies, he doesn't use these art songs. He uses just popular songs, ballad songs, and then not even complete ballads or songs, but little snatches, a couple of lines here, or maybe a stanza there. And that's all he puts into the tragedy. So I just took that as a kind of a departure to look at the tragedies from this point of this seeming cast in Shakespeare's mind. Why did he do this, and what does that tell me about the tragedies, or perhaps about the comedies? And what you discover is, well, as I was telling the guy, you can go in several different directions from this. And I tried to look into each one of these directions. For example, just the fact that you say the tragedies have bits of songs, the comedies have complete songs. Immediately, if you're going to make a statement like that, you're going to have to defend yourself against somebody's question. Well, what do you mean by tragedy, and what do you mean by comedy? Which one's a tragedy?
Leave your clothes. I'm going on.
All right.
So you run into the problem of definition or categorization. What plays did Shakespeare apparently think were comedies, and which one did he think were tragedies? And you run into some interesting things here. Some of the things that Hemings and Condell thought or stuck under the labels of tragedies, Shakespeare apparently didn't think were tragedies from the basis of the way he uses the music.
Like Caesar, Cleopatra, what do you call it? Oh, Charlotte.
Charlotte and Cressida. Yeah. A lot of people treat that as a tragedy, and of course there's some reason to do so. After all, Travis dies at the end of it, and he gets the short end of the stick, and all these things. But in Travis and Cresta, there are none of these ballad things, except at the very end, where Pandarus sort of recites a little doggerel, and I'm not even sure that that's a part of the song. But there is this this full-blown art song in it. Love, love, nothing but love. And it's used very adroitly for dramatic purposes, but it is a complete art song, like you have in the comedies.
Mm-hmm.
So you can argue that, well, some people might call this a comedy, and it may have some of the marks, I mean a tragedy, or have some of the marks of a tragedy in it. But apparently, the way Shakespeare saw it, he was thinking more in comic terms than he was in tragic terms. So if you consider his story of Troilus and Cressida as a tragedy, or sleeting the courage, as Chaucer calls it, you may be wrong. That wasn't his intention. And it tells a lot about the stage crew, the jester, because the jester is the prime stage character in the tragedy that uses these little ballad fragments. And that goes way back into stage tradition.
Now this is something.
You look back in the early interludes, such as the Play of the Weather or Wit and Science, some of these that have this fool or moros or ignoros, some other name they give to it. It is the fool that is given what's called a ballad medley. That is a ballad to sing that is made up of bits or lines taken from other older songs or ballads and strung together to create a sort of form of nonsense. But like many of these nonsensical things, sometimes these lines fall together so that they create a seeming rational statement or situation, but then it's purely by accident that it does, and it dissolves again within the next two or three lines into nonsense. And you can find examples of these ballad medleys in the early interludes all the way up to Shakespeare's time. And I spent a whole chapter in the book just talking about this ballad medley. And incidentally studied some philology, picked it up and ran it as a separate article.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the ballad medley. But what this tells us about the crew is that he sees the world in a fragmented way. Things don't add up to the fool. He sees bits and pieces of things, but they never come together. They never become focused for him into any coherent image or idea. You look at the etymology of the word, motley, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Motley means a mixture of things, and usually associated with fool's dress or costume, fool's motley. And you discover, if you check your OED, that it is, in Shakespeare's time, synonymous with the word medley, which means a mixture also. And the ballad medley, you see, is a musical, becomes a musical version of the fool's motley, which are patches patches and scraps of different colored cloth, in spite of Leslie Hodson's idea that it's not patches. it flies in the face of a great deal of evidence, because another name for the fool is a patch. We call him a patch. Yeah, patch. And, yeah. And who was it? Cardinal. Wolsey. Who was named Patch. And you can find all these connections between the word patch, medley, motley, fool, antic. Antic is another. It's all etymologically connected. So there's that evidence. Then you look in the plays, what Shakespeare does with them. Every time you run across these ballad medleys, they're either sung by a fool or a person acting like a fool, such as Hamlet frequently does in the play, or someone who is simple-minded, like a natural fool, or someone who is insane, such as Ophelia, or someone who is acting the part of a clown, like the grave digger, the first grave digger in Hamlet. Or someone like Edmund in King Lear, who is taking the part of Mad Tom of Bedlam. You'll sing these snatches, and he even sings one time in Lear, he and the fool sing a duet, part of a ballad, Come Over to Burn Bessie, Come Over to Me. So, looking at this, you see that Shakespeare is using the ballad and an old tradition, a stage tradition, to take us into the minds of some of the characters by means of these ballad fragments, into the, not necessarily what they are thinking at the moment, but the way they think and see the world. When Ophelia moves around singing these little bits of ballads and handing out the flowers to Gertrude and Claudius and Laertes, she makes references to different situations in the old ballads that the audience knew, very popular, most of them would have known, in the same way that Shakespeare in the comedies would make references, or sometimes in tragedies, to Priam or Dido or Aeneas, with the belief that his courtly audience would catch these references just as quickly. So the ballad becomes a way of getting into or revealing the minds of some of the characters, just as a soliloquy does. The first gentleman in Hamlet, when he's talking to the queen about Ophelia's madness, he comes on the stage and he says he has about 20 lines all about Ophelia. Then he disappears. The only reason he's been put on stage is to make this statement about Ophelia. And he says something to the fact that she speaks nonsense, that her words are wild and whirling words, and that you strain to understand what she's saying, and that sometimes even it sounds like she's saying something rational, and you think that you it brings to mind something that you think is what she is saying, and then it whirls away into madness again. And then he doesn't say anything more about Ophelia's language. Then Ophelia comes in and sings these little bits of ballads. Of course, she talks too. She has this talk about the fishmonger or the baker's daughter and all these old childhood allusions to childhood games and songs, But when she turns to each one of these characters, Gertrude and the king, she will sing one of these snatches of ballad, and she will hand a particular kind of flower to that character. And then that character will make a statement about what they are thinking about when she does this. And then she'll hand, she'll sing another snatch of a ballad, and she'll hand another kind of flower to Claudius. And then he will make a statement about what this suggests in his mind. And then she will sing another snatch of a ballad and hand a flower to Laertes. And Laertes will say what that reminds him of, swift revenge for what has happened to it.
But that's in the text scene, not all
at
one place.
Oh, it's all, well, it's all in one scene.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yes. Right.
Sustained.
Sustained, all the way through. And she keeps up for herself some room.
What is that about the comedy? That's not the common fare. That's more courtly?
Yeah. If you look at the fact that Shakespeare puts these art songs in the comedies and doesn't use them, not a one, so far as I can determine, in the tragedies, that would suggest that since the art song is a fairly sophisticated kind of musical composition, not too sophisticated, but it's in there for entertainment as well as dramatic functions. It's intrinsically a pleasant piece of music performed on stage in its entirety. Or mostly so, that it is intended to appeal to a more sophisticated audience than the popular songs, and therefore that the comedy, and I think there's evidence elsewhere for this, that Shakespeare thought of the comedy as court, primarily as court entertainment. He writes the comedies for special occasions, for the court, or for courtly audience. Such as he wrote Midsummer Night's Dream for a noble wedding. He wrote The Tempest for King James, and later used it in its second performance for the wedding of James's daughter, Elizabeth, the Prince Elector of Palatine State. And most of the comedies are written for special occasions, but the tragedies, no. You can't associate a special occasion.
That gives a wholly different feeling for the comedy.
Yeah.
It's more, I don't know what you'd call it, more formal?
It's certainly more formal, but it's also more foreign. Because the court, Elizabeth's court, in a manner of speaking, as far as the English nation was concerned, is a sort of a foreign court. In the court, you're expected to speak Italian and French and to know Italianate literature, and it's not the countryside by any means.
You mean the Jack Farm?
Right.
Where they would even go in for Italian and French.
Yeah.
Right. And
I don't know whether they all did, but that was the manners of the time, that was the culture